solve problems typically choose easier problems and therefore learn less. The short-term prize crowds out the long-term learning. In environments where extrinsic rewards are most salient, many people work only to the point that triggers the reward and no further. So if students get a prize for reading 3 books, many won't pick up a 4th, let alone embark on a lifetime of reading. Just as executives who hit their quarterly numbers often won't boost earnings a penny more, let alone contemplate the long-term health of their companies. Likewise, several studies show that paying people to exercise, stop smoking, or take their medicines produces terrific results at first. But the healthy behavior disappears once the incentives are removed. However, when contingent rewards aren't involved, or when the incentives are used with the proper deftness, performance improves and understanding deepens. Greatness and nearsightedness are incompatible. Meaningful achievement depends on lifting one's sights and pushing toward the horizon. Let me summarize the 7 deadly flaws of carrots and sticks. 1. They can extinguish intrinsic motivation. 2. They can diminish performance. 3. They can crush creativity. 4. They can crowd out good behavior. 5. They can encourage cheating, shortcuts, and unethical behavior. 6. They can become addictive. 7. They can foster short-term thinking. Chapter 2A, and the special circumstances when they do. Carrots and sticks aren't all bad. If they were, Motivation 2.0 would never have flourished so long or accomplished so much. While an operating system centered around rewards and punishments has outlived its usefulness and badly needs an upgrade, that doesn't mean we should scrap its every piece. Indeed, doing so would run counter to the science. The scholars exploring human motivation have revealed not only the many glitches in the traditional approach, but also the narrow band of circumstances in which carrots and sticks do their jobs reasonably well. The starting point, of course, is to ensure that the baseline rewards, wages, salaries, benefits, and so on, are adequate and fair. Without a healthy baseline, motivation of any sort is difficult and often impossible. But once that's established, there are circumstances where it's okay to fall back on extrinsic motivators. To understand what those circumstances are, let's return to the candle problem. In his study, Sam Glucksberg found that the participants who were offered a cash prize took longer to solve the problem than those working in a reward-free environment. The reason, you'll recall, is that the prospect of a prize narrowed participants' focus and limited their ability to see an inventive, non-obvious solution. In the same experiment, Glucksberg presented a separate set of participants with a slightly different version of the problem. Once again, he told half of them he was timing their performance to collect data, and the other half that those who posted the fastest times could win cash. But he altered things just a bit. Instead of giving participants a box full of tacks, he emptied the tacks onto the desk. Can you guess what happened? This time, the participants vying for the reward solved the problem faster than their counterparts. Why? By removing the tacks and displaying the empty box, Glucksberg essentially revealed the solution. He transformed a challenging right-brain task into a routine left-brain one. Since participants simply had to race down an obvious path, the carrot waiting for them at the finish line encouraged them to gallop faster. Glucksberg's experiment provides the first question you should ask when contemplating external motivators. Is the task at hand routine? That is, does accomplishing it require following a prescribed set of rules to a specified end? For routine tasks, which aren't very interesting and don't demand much creative thinking, rewards can provide a small motivational booster shot without the harmful side effects. In some ways, that's just common sense. As Edward Deci, Richard Ryan, and Richard Kestner explain, rewards do not undermine people's intrinsic motivation for dull tasks because there is little or no intrinsic motivation to be undermined. Likewise, when Dan Ariely and his colleagues conducted their Madurai, India performance study with a group of MIT students, they found that when the task called for even rudimentary cognitive skill, a larger reward led to poorer performance. But as long as the task involved only mechanical skill, bonuses worked as they would be expected. The higher the pay, the better the performance. This is extremely important. Although advanced economies now revolve less around those algorithmic rule-based functions, some of what we do each day, especially on the job, still isn't all that interesting. We have TPS reports to fill out, and boring email to answer, and all manner of drudge work that doesn't necessarily fire our soul. What's more, for some people, much of what they do all day consists of these routine, not terribly captivating tasks. In these situations, it's best to try to unleash the positive side of the Sawyer effect by attempting to turn work into play, to increase the task's variety, to make it more like a game, or to use it to help master other skills. Alas, that's not always possible, and this means that sometimes, even if-then rewards are an option. Let's put this insight about rewards and routines into practice. Suppose you're a manager at a small nonprofit organization. Your design team created a terrific poster promoting your group's next big event, and now you need to send the poster to 20,000 members of your organization. Since the costs of outsourcing the job to a professional mailing firm are too steep for your budget, you decide to do the work in-house. Trouble is, the posters came back from the printer much later than you expected, and they need to get in the mail this weekend. What's the best way to enlist your staff of 10 and maybe a few others in a massive weekend poster mailing session? The task is the very definition of routine. The people participating must roll up the posters, slide them into the mailing tubes, cap those tubes, and apply a mailing label and the proper postage. Four steps, none of them notably interesting. One managerial option is coercion. If you're the boss, you could force people to spend their Saturday and Sunday on this mind-numbing project. They might comply, but the damage to their morale and long-term commitment could be substantial. Another option is to ask for volunteers. But face it, most people can think of far better ways to spend a weekend. So in this case, an if-then reward might be effective. For instance, you could promise a big office-wide party if everybody pitches in on the project. You could offer a gift certificate to everyone who participates. Or you could go further and pay people a small sum for every poster they insert, enclose, and send, in the hope that the piecework fee will boost their productivity. While such tangible contingent rewards can often undermine intrinsic motivation and creativity, those drawbacks matter less here. The assignment neither inspires deep passion nor requires deep thinking. Carrots in this case won't hurt and might help. And you'll increase your chances of success by supplementing the poster packing rewards with three important practices. First, offer a rationale for why the task is necessary. A job that's not inherently interesting can become more meaningful and therefore more engaging if it's part of a larger purpose. Explain why this poster is so important and why sending it out now is critical to your organization's mission. Second, acknowledge that the task is boring. This is an act of empathy, of course, and the acknowledgement will help people understand why this is the rare instance when if-then rewards are part of how your organization operates. Third, allow people to complete the task their own way. Think autonomy, not control. State the outcome you need, but instead of specifying precisely the way to reach it, how each poster must be rolled and how each mailing label must be affixed, give them freedom over how they do the job. That's the approach for routine tasks. What about for other sorts of undertakings? For work that requires more than just climbing rung by rung up a ladder of instructions, rewards are more perilous. The best way to avoid the seven deadly flaws of extrinsic motivators is to avoid them altogether or to downplay them significantly and instead emphasize the elements of deeper motivation, autonomy, mastery, and purpose that we'll explore later in the book. But in the workplace, a rigid adherence to this approach bumps up against a fact of life. Even people who do groovy, creative, right-brain work still want to be paid. And here, Teresa Amabile has shed some light on how to use rewards in a way that reckons with life's realities, but reduces extrinsic motivators' hidden costs. Go back to the study in which Amabile and two colleagues compared the quality of commissioned and non-commissioned paintings from a group of artists. A panel of experts, blind to what the investigators were exploring, consistently rated the non-commissioned artwork as more creative. One reason is that several artists said their commissions were constraining, that they found themselves working toward a goal they didn't endorse in a manner they didn't control. However, in the same study, Amabile also discovered that when the artists considered their commissions enabling, that is, the commission enabled the artist to do something interesting or exciting, the creativity ranking of what they produced shot back up. The same was true for commissions the artists felt provided them with useful information and feedback about their ability. This is a crucial research insight. The science shows that it is possible, though tricky, to incorporate rewards into non-routine, more creative settings without causing a cascade of damage. So, suppose we're back at your nonprofit 9 months later. The mailing went out flawlessly. The poster was a hit. The event was a smash. You're planning another for later this year. You've settled on the date and found your venue. Now you need an inspiring poster to captivate imaginations and draw a crowd. What should you do? Here's what you shouldn't do. Offer an if-then reward to the design staff. Do not stride into their offices and announce, "If you come up with a poster that rocks my world or that boosts attendance over last year, then you'll get a 10% bonus." Although that motivational approach is common in organizations all over the world, it's a recipe for reduced performance. Creating a poster isn't routine. It requires conceptual, breakthrough, artistic thinking. And as we've learned, if-then rewards are an ideal way to squash this sort of thinking. Your best approach is to have already established the conditions of a genuinely motivating environment. The baseline rewards must be sufficient, that is, the team's basic compensation must be adequate and fair, particularly compared with people doing similar work for similar organizations. Your nonprofit must be a congenial place to work. And the people on your team must have autonomy, they must have ample opportunity to pursue mastery, and their daily duties must relate to a larger purpose. If these elements are in place, the best strategy is to provide a sense of urgency and significance and then get out of the talent's way. But you may still be able to boost performance a bit, more for future tasks than for this one, through the delicate use of rewards. Just be careful. Your efforts will backfire unless the rewards you offer meet one essential requirement, and you'll be on firmer motivational footing if you follow two additional principles. The essential requirement: any extrinsic reward should be unexpected and offered only after the task is complete. Holding out a prize at the beginning of a project and offering it as a contingency will inevitably focus people's attention on obtaining the reward rather than on attacking the problem. But introducing the subject of rewards after the job is done is less risky. In other words, where if-then rewards are a mistake, shift to now-that rewards, as in, now that you've finished the poster and it turned out so well, I'd like to celebrate by taking you out to lunch. As DC and his colleagues explain, if tangible rewards are given unexpectedly to people after they have finished a task, the rewards are less likely to be experienced as the reason for doing the task and are thus less likely to be detrimental to intrinsic motivation. Likewise, Amabile has found in some studies that the highest levels of creativity were produced by subjects who received a reward as a kind of a bonus. So when the poster turns out great, you could buy the design team a case of beer or even hand them a cash bonus without snuffing their creativity. The team didn't expect any extras, and getting them didn't hinge on a particular outcome. You're simply offering your appreciation for their stellar work. But keep in mind one ginormous caveat. Repeated now-that bonuses can quickly become expected if-then entitlements, which can ultimately crater effective performance. At this point, by limiting rewards for non-routine creative work to the unexpected now-that variety, you're in less dangerous waters. but you'll do even better if you follow two more guidelines. First, consider non-tangible rewards. Praise and positive feedback are much less corrosive than cash and trophies. In fact, in DC's original experiments and in his subsequent analysis of other studies, he found that positive feedback can have an enhancing effect on intrinsic motivation. So if the folks on the design team turn out a show-stopping poster, maybe just walk into their offices and say, "Wow, you did a really amazing job on that poster. It's going to have a huge impact on getting people to come to this event. Thank you." It sounds small and simple, but it can have an enormous effect. Second, provide useful information. Amabile has found that while controlling extrinsic motivators can clobber creativity, informational or enabling motivators can be conducive to it. In the workplace, people are thirsting to learn about how they're doing, but only if the information isn't a tacit effort to manipulate their behavior. So don't tell the design team, "That poster was perfect. You did it exactly the way I asked." Instead, give people meaningful information about their work. The more feedback focuses on specifics, great use of color, and the more the praise is about effort and strategy rather than about achieving a particular outcome, the more effective it can be. In brief, for creative right-brain heuristic tasks, you're on shaky ground offering if-then rewards. You're better off using now-that rewards, and you're best off if your now-that rewards provide praise, feedback, and useful information. Chapter 3, Type I and Type X. Rochester, New York is an unlikely epicenter for a social earthquake. The companies that built this stolid city just 62 miles from the Canadian border were titans of the industrial economy. Eastman Kodak made film. Western Union delivered telegrams. Xerox produced photocopiers. And they piloted their enterprises by the precepts of Motivation 2.0. If you offer people steady employment and carefully calibrated rewards, they'll do what executives and shareholders want, and everyone will prosper. But starting in the 1970s, on the campus of the University of Rochester, a motivational revolution was brewing. It began in 1971, when Edward Deci, fresh from his SOMA puzzle experiments, arrived on campus for a joint appointment in the psychology department and the business school. It intensified in 1973, when the business school unceremoniously booted Deci because of his heretical findings about rewards, and the psychology department hired him full-time. It gathered more steam in 1975, when Deci published a book called Intrinsic Motivation. And it launched in earnest in 1977, when a student named Richard Ryan showed up for graduate school. Ryan, a philosophy major in college, had just missed being drafted into the military. Nursing a bit of survivor's guilt, he'd been working with Vietnam War veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And he'd come to the University of Rochester to learn how to become a better clinician. One day, in a seminar, a professor brought up the subject of intrinsic motivation and then denounced it with table-pounding ferocity. "I figured that if there was that much resistance, this must be something interesting," Ryan told me. He picked up a copy of Deci's book, found it compelling, and asked its author to lunch. So commenced a remarkable research collaboration that continues to this day. When I met them not long ago in a blocky U of R office building, the two were a study in both contrast and similarity. Deci is tall and reedy, with a pale complexion and thin, wispy hair. He speaks in a quiet, soothing voice that reminded me of the late American children's television host, Mr. Rogers. Ryan, who has straight white hair parted down the middle, is ruddier and more intense. He presses his point like a skilled litigator. Deci, meanwhile, waits patiently for you to reach his point, then agrees with you and praises your insight. Deci is the classical music station on your FM dial. Ryan is more cable TV. And yet they talk to each other in a cryptic academic shorthand, their ideas smoothly in sync. The combination has been powerful enough to make them among the most influential behavioral scientists of their generation. Together, DC and Ryan have fashioned what they call self-determination theory. Many theories of behavior pivot around a particular human tendency. We're keen responders to positive and negative reinforcements, or zippy calculators of our self-interest, or lumpy duffel bags of psychosexual conflicts. SDT, by contrast, begins with a notion of universal human needs. It argues that we have three innate psychological needs: competence, autonomy, and relatedness. When those needs are satisfied, we're motivated, productive, and happy. When they're thwarted, our motivation, productivity, and happiness plummet. If there's anything fundamental about our nature, it's the capacity for interest. Some things facilitate it, some things undermine it, Ryan explained during one of our conversations. Put another way, we've all got that third drive. It's part of what it means to be human. But whether that aspect of our humanity emerges in our lives depends on whether the conditions around us support it. And the main mechanisms of motivation 2.0 are more stifling than supportive. This is a really big thing in management, says Ryan. When people aren't producing, companies typically resort to rewards or punishment. What you haven't done is the hard work of diagnosing what the problem is. You're trying to run over the problem with a carrot or a stick, Ryan explains. That doesn't mean that SDT unequivocally opposes rewards. Of course, they're necessary in workplaces and other settings, says DC. But the less salient they are made, the better. When people use rewards to motivate, that's when they're most demotivating. Instead, DC and Ryan say we should focus our efforts on creating environments for our innate psychological needs to flourish. Over the last 30 years, through both their scholarship and mentorship, DC and Ryan have established a network of several dozen SDT scholars conducting research in the United States, Canada, Israel, Singapore, and throughout Western Europe. These scientists have explored self-determination and intrinsic motivation in laboratory experiments and field studies that encompass just about every realm: business, education, medicine, sports, exercise, personal productivity, environmentalism, relationships, and physical and mental health. They have produced hundreds of research papers, most of which point to the same conclusion. Human beings have an innate inner drive to be autonomous, self-determined, and connected to one another. And when that drive is liberated, people achieve more and live richer lives. SDT is an important part of a broad swirl of new thinking about the human condition. This constellation includes, perhaps most prominently, the positive psychology movement, which has reoriented the study of psychological science away from its previous focus on malady and dysfunction and toward well-being and effective functioning. Under the leadership of the University of Pennsylvania's Martin Seligman, positive psychology has been minting legions of new scholars and leaving a deep imprint on how scientists, economists, therapists, and everyday people think about human behavior. One of positive psychology's most influential figures is Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, whom I mentioned earlier. Csikszentmihalyi's first book about flow and Seligman's first book on his theories, which argued that helplessness was learned rather than innate behavior, appeared in the same year as DC's book on intrinsic motivation. Clearly something big was in the air in 1975. It's just taken us a generation to reckon with it. This broad assortment of new thinkers includes Carol Dweck of Stanford University and Harvard's Amabile. It includes a few economists, most prominently Roland Benabou of Princeton University and Bruno Frey of the University of Zurich, who are applying some of these concepts to the dismal science. And it includes some scholars who don't study motivation per se, in particular Harvard University's Howard Gardner and Tufts University's Robert Sternberg, who have changed our view of intelligence and creativity and offered a brighter view of human potential. This collection of scholars, not in concert, not intentionally, and perhaps not even knowing they've been doing so, has been creating the foundation for a new, more effective operating system. At long last, the times may be catching up to their work. The power of the alphabet. Words matter, of course, but so do letters. Case in point, Meyer Friedman. You've probably never heard of him, but you almost certainly know his legacy. Friedman, who died in 2001 at the ripe old age of 90, was a cardiologist who for decades ran a bustling office in San Francisco. In the late 1950s, he and fellow physician Ray Rosenman began noticing similarities in their patients who were prone to heart disease. It wasn't only what these patients ate or what genes they inherited that affected their susceptibility to coronary trouble. It was also how they led their lives. These patients, Friedman noted, demonstrated a particular complex of personality traits, including excessive competition drive, aggressiveness, impatience, and a harrying sense of time urgency. Individuals displaying this pattern seem to be engaged in a chronic, ceaseless, and often fruitless struggle with themselves, with others, with circumstances, with time, sometimes with life itself. These people were significantly more likely to develop heart disease than other patients, even those who shared similar physical attributes, exercise regimens, diets, and family histories. Looking for a convenient and memorable way to explain this insight to their medical colleagues and the wider world, Friedman and Rosenman found inspiration in the alphabet. They dubbed this behavioral pattern Type A. Type A behavior stood in contrast to, naturally, Type B behavior. Unlike their horn-honking, foot-tapping counterparts who suffered from hurry sickness, people displaying Type B behavior were rarely harried by life or made hostile by its demands. In their research, Friedman and Rosenman found that Type B people were just as intelligent and frequently just as ambitious as Type A's, but they wore their ambition differently. Writing about the Type B person, and using the male-centered language common in the day, the cardiologist explained, "He may also have a considerable amount of drive, but its character is such that it seems to steady him, give confidence and security to him, rather than to goad, irritate, and infuriate, as with the Type A man. One key to reducing deaths from heart disease and improving public health, therefore, was to help Type A's learn to become a little more like Type B's." 50 years later, this nomenclature remains. The two letters help us understand a complex web of behaviors and guide us toward a better and more effective way to live. Around the same time that Friedman and Rosenman were making their discovery, another American was pushing frontiers of his own. Douglas McGregor was a management professor at MIT who brought to the job an interesting combination of experiences. He'd earned a PhD from Harvard in psychology, rather than in economics or engineering. And in contrast to most of his colleagues, he'd actually run an institution. From 1948 to 1954, he was president of Antioch College. Drawing on his understanding of the human psyche, as well as his experience as a leader, McGregor began rethinking the conventions of modern management. He thought that the problem with corporate leadership wasn't so much its execution as its premises. Beginning with a speech in 1957, and later in a groundbreaking book called The Human Side of Enterprise in 1960, McGregor argued that those running companies were operating from faulty assumptions about human behavior. Most leaders believed that the people in their organizations fundamentally disliked work and would avoid it if they could. These faceless minions feared taking responsibility, craved security, and badly needed direction. As a result, most people must be coerced, controlled, directed, and threatened with punishment to get them to put forth adequate effort toward the achievement of organizational objectives. But McGregor said there was an alternative view of employees, one that offered a more accurate assessment of the human condition and a more effective starting point for running companies. This perspective held that taking an interest in work is as natural as play or rest, that creativity and ingenuity were widely distributed in the population, and that under the proper conditions, people will accept and even seek responsibility. To explain these contrasting outlooks, McGregor mined the back end of the alphabet. He called the first view theory X, and the second, theory Y. If your starting point was theory X, he said, your managerial techniques would inevitably produce limited results, or even go awry entirely. If you believed in the mediocrity of the masses, as he put it, then mediocrity became the ceiling on what you could achieve. But if your starting point was theory Y, the possibilities were vast, not simply for the individual's potential, but for the company's bottom line as well. The way to make business organizations work better, therefore, was to shift management thinking away from theory X and toward theory Y. Once again, the nomenclature stuck, and McGregor's approach soon became a staple of management education. A picture may be worth a thousand words, but sometimes neither is as potent as just two letters. So, with a hoist from Meyer Friedman onto the shoulders of Douglas McGregor, I'd like to introduce my own alphabetic way to think about human motivation. Type I and Type X. The Motivation 2.0 operating system depended on and fostered what I call Type X behavior. Type X behavior is fueled more by extrinsic desires than intrinsic ones. It concerns itself less with the inherent satisfaction of an activity and more with the external rewards to which that activity leads. The Motivation 3.0 operating system, the upgrade that's needed to meet the new realities of how we organize, think about, and do what we do, depends on what I call Type I behavior. Type I behavior is fueled more by intrinsic desires than extrinsic ones. It concerns itself less with the external rewards to which an activity leads and more with the inherent satisfaction of the activity itself. At the center of Type X behavior is the second drive. At the center of Type I behavior is the third drive. If we want to strengthen our organizations, get beyond our decade of underachievement, and address the inchoate sense that something's gone wrong in our businesses, our lives, and our world, we need to move from Type X to Type I. I use these two letters largely to signify extrinsic and intrinsic, but also to pay homage to Douglas McGregor. To be sure, reducing human behavior to two categories sacrifices a certain amount of nuance. And nobody exhibits purely Type X or Type I behavior every waking minute of every living day without exception. But we do have certain, often very clear dispositions. You probably know what I mean. Think about yourself. Does what energizes you, what gets you up in the morning and propels you through the day, come from the inside or from the outside? What about your spouse, your partner, or your children? How about the men and women around you at work? If you're like most people I've talked to, you instantly have a sense into which category someone belongs. You can even try this with people you don't know. See if you agree. Enron's Jeff Skilling was Type X. Berkshire Hathaway's Warren Buffett is Type I. Antonio Salieri was Type X. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was Type I. The very wealthy Donald Trump is Type X. The even wealthier Oprah Winfrey is Type I. Former CEO of GE Jack Welch is Type X. Interface Global founder Ray Anderson is Type I. Simon Cowell is Type X. Bruce Springsteen is Type I. I don't mean to say that Type X people always neglect the inherent enjoyment of what they do, or that Type I people resist outside goodies of any kind. But for Type X's, the main motivator is external rewards. Any deeper satisfaction is welcome, but secondary. For Type I's, the main motivator is the freedom, challenge, and purpose of the undertaking itself. Any other gains are welcome, but mainly as a bonus. A few more distinctions to keep in mind before we go further. Type I behavior is made, not born. These behavioral patterns aren't fixed traits. They are proclivities that emerge from circumstance, experience, and context. Type I behavior, because it arises in part from universal human needs, does not depend on age, gender, or nationality. The science demonstrates that once people learn the fundamental practices and attitudes and can exercise them in supportive settings, their motivation and their ultimate performance soars. Any Type X can become a Type I. Type I's almost always outperform Type X's in the long run. Intrinsically motivated people usually achieve more than their reward-seeking counterparts. Alas, that's not always true in the short term. An intense focus on extrinsic rewards can indeed deliver fast results. The trouble is, this approach is difficult to sustain, and it doesn't assist in mastery, which is the source of achievement over the long haul. The most successful people, the evidence shows, often aren't directly pursuing conventional notions of success. They're working hard and persisting through difficulties because of their internal desire to control their lives, learn about their world, and accomplish something that endures. Type I behavior does not disdain money or recognition. Both Type X's and Type I's care about money. If an employee's compensation doesn't hit the baseline that I described in Chapter 2, if her organization doesn't pay her an adequate amount, or if her pay isn't equitable compared to others doing similar work, that person's motivation will crater, regardless of whether she leans toward X or toward I. However, once compensation meets that level, money plays a different role for Type I's than for Type X's. Type I's don't turn down raises or refuse to cash paychecks, but one reason fair and adequate pay is so essential is that it takes the issue of money off the table so they can focus on the work itself. By contrast, for many Type X's, money is the table. It's why they do what they do. Recognition is similar. Type I's like being recognized for their accomplishments because recognition is a form of feedback. But for them, unlike for Type X's, recognition is not a goal in itself. Type I behavior is a renewable resource. Think of Type X behavior as coal and Type I behavior as the sun. For most of recent history, coal has been the cheapest, easiest, and most efficient resource. But coal has two downsides. First, it produces nasty things like air pollution and greenhouse gases. Second, it's finite. Getting more of it becomes increasingly difficult and expensive each year. Type X behavior is similar. An emphasis on rewards and punishments spews its own externalities, as enumerated in Chapter 2. And if-then motivators always grow more expensive. But Type I behavior, which is built around intrinsic motivation, draws on resources that are easily replenished and inflict little damage. It is the motivational equivalent of clean energy, inexpensive, safe to use, and endlessly renewable. Type I behavior promotes greater physical and mental well-being. According to a raft of studies from SDT researchers, people oriented toward autonomy and intrinsic motivation have higher self-esteem, better interpersonal relationships, and greater general well-being than those who are extrinsically motivated. By contrast, people whose core aspirations are Type X validation such as money, fame, or beauty tend to have poorer psychological health. There's even a connection between Type X and Type A. DC has found that those oriented toward control and extrinsic rewards show greater public self-consciousness, act more defensively, and are more likely to exhibit the Type A behavior pattern. Ultimately, Type I behavior depends on three nutrients: autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Type I behavior is self-directed. It is devoted to becoming better and better at something that matters, and it connects the quest for excellence to a larger purpose. Some might dismiss notions like these as gooey and idealistic, but the science says otherwise. The science confirms that this sort of behavior is essential to being human, and that now, in a rapidly changing economy, it is also critical for professional, personal, and organizational success of any kind. So we have a choice. We can cling to a view of human motivation that is grounded more in old habits than in modern science, or we can listen to the research, drag our business and personal practices into the 21st century, and craft a new operating system to help ourselves, our companies, and our world work a little better. It won't be easy. It won't happen overnight. So let's get started. Part 2. The Three Elements. Chapter 4. Autonomy. I've seen the future, and it works. It works in around-the-clock bursts in Sydney, Australia. It works on guerrilla-style side projects in Mountain View, California. And it works whenever it damn well pleases in Charlottesville, Virginia. The reason why it works is because of how it works. On the edges of the economy, slowly but inexorably, old-fashioned ideas of management are giving way to a newfangled emphasis on self-direction. That's why a little past noon on a rainy Friday in Charlottesville, only a third of CEO Jeff Gunther's employees have shown up for work. But Gunther, entrepreneur, manager, capitalist, is neither worried nor annoyed. In fact, he's as calm and focused as a monk. Maybe that's because he didn't roll into the office himself until about an hour ago. Or maybe that's because he knows his crew isn't shirking. They're working, just on their own terms. At the beginning of the year, Gunther launched an experiment in autonomy at Medius, one of a trio of companies he runs. He turned the company, which creates computer software and hardware to help hospitals integrate their information systems, into a ROWE, R-O-W-E, a results-only work environment. ROWEs are the brainchild of Callie Ressler and Jody Thompson, two former human resources executives at the American retailer Best Buy. ROWE's principles marry the common-sense pragmatism of Ben Franklin to the cage-rattling radicalism of Saul Alinsky. In a ROWE workplace, people don't have schedules. They show up when they want. They don't have to be in the office at a certain time, or any time for that matter. They just have to get their work done. How they do it, when they do it, and where they do it is up to them. That appealed to Gunther, who's in his early 30s. Management isn't about walking around and seeing if people are in their offices, he told me. It's about creating conditions for people to do their best work. That's why he'd always tried to give employees a long leash. But as Medius expanded, and as Gunther began exploring new office space, he started wondering whether talented, grown-up employees doing sophisticated work needed a leash of any length. So at the company's holiday dinner in December 2008, he made an announcement. For the first 90 days of the new year, the entire 22-person operation would try an experiment. It would become a ROWE. In the beginning, people didn't take to it, Gunther says. The office filled up around 9 a.m. and emptied out in the early evening just as before. A few staffers had come out of extremely controlling environments and weren't accustomed to this kind of leeway. At one employee's previous company, staff had to arrive each day by 8 a.m. If someone was late, even by a few minutes, the employee had to write an explanation for everyone else to read. But after a few weeks, most people found their groove. Productivity rose, stress declined. And although two employees struggled with the freedom and left, by the end of the test period, Gunther decided to go with ROWE permanently. Some people outside of the company thought I was crazy, he says. They wondered, how can you know what your employees are doing if they're not here? But in his view, the team was accomplishing more under this new arrangement. One reason? They were focused on the work itself rather than on whether someone would call them a slacker for leaving at 3 p.m. to watch a daughter's soccer game. And since the bulk of his staff consists of software developers, designers, and others doing high-level creative work, that was essential. For them, it's all about craftsmanship, Gunther says, and they need a lot of autonomy. People still had specific goals they had to reach. For example, completing a project by a certain time or ringing up a particular number of sales. And if they needed help, Gunther was there to assist. But he decided against tying those goals to compensation. That creates a culture that says it's all about money and not enough about the work. Money, he believes, is only a threshold motivator. People must be paid well and be able to take care of their families, he says. But once a company meets this baseline, dollars and cents don't much affect performance and motivation. Indeed, Gunther thinks that in a ROWE environment, employees are far less likely to jump to another job for a $10,000 or even $20,000 increase in salary. The freedom they have to do great work is more valuable and harder to match than a pay raise. And employees' spouses, partners, and families are among Roe's staunchest advocates. More companies will migrate to this as more business owners my age come up. My dad's generation views human beings as human resources. They're the 2x4s you need to build your house, he says. For me, it's a partnership between me and the employees. They're not resources. They're partners. And partners, like all of us, need to direct their own lives. Players or pawns. We forget sometimes that management does not emanate from nature. It's not like a tree or a river. It's like a television or a bicycle. It's something that humans invented. As the strategy guru Gary Hamel has observed, management is a technology. And like Motivation 2.0, it's a technology that has grown creaky. While some companies have oiled the gears a bit, and plenty more have paid lip service to the same, at its core, management hasn't changed much in 100 years. Its central ethic remains control. Its chief tools remain extrinsic motivators. That leaves it largely out of sync with the non-routine right-brain abilities on which many of the world's economies now depend. But could its most glaring weakness run deeper? Is management, as it's currently constituted, out of sync with human nature itself? The idea of management, that is management of people rather than management of, say, supply chains, is built on certain assumptions about the basic natures of those being managed. It presumes that to take action or move forward, we need a prod, that absent a reward or punishment, we'd remain happily and inertly in place. It also presumes that once people do get moving, they need direction, that without a firm and reliable guide, they'd wander. But is that really our fundamental nature? Or to use yet another computer metaphor, is that our default setting? When we enter the world, are we wired to be passive and inert? Or are we wired to be active and engaged? I'm convinced it's the latter, that our basic nature is to be curious and self-directed. And I say that not because I'm a dewy-eyed idealist, but because I've been around young children and because my wife and I have 3 kids of our own. Have you ever seen a 6-month-old or a 1-year-old who's not curious and self-directed? I haven't. That's how we are out of the box. If at age 14 or 43 we're passive and inert, that's not because it's our nature. It's because something flipped our default setting. That something could well be management. Not merely how bosses treat us at work, but also how the broader ethos has leached into schools, families, and many other aspects of our lives. Perhaps management isn't responding to our supposedly natural state of passive inertia. Perhaps management is one of the forces that's switching our default setting and producing that state. Now, that's not as insidious as it sounds. Submerging part of our nature in the name of economic survival can be a sensible move. My ancestors did it. So did yours. And there are times, even now, when we have no other choice. But today, economic accomplishment, not to mention personal fulfillment, more often swings on a different hinge. It depends not on keeping our nature submerged, but on allowing it to surface. It requires resisting the temptation to control people and instead doing everything we can to reawaken their deep-seated sense of autonomy. This innate capacity for self-direction is at the heart of Motivation 3.0 and Type I behavior. The fundamentally autonomous quality of human nature is central to self-determination theory. As I explained in the previous chapter, Deasy and Ryan cite autonomy as one of 3 basic human needs. And of the 3, it's the most important, the sun around which SDT's planets orbit. In the 1980s, as they progressed in their work, Deasy and Ryan moved away from categorizing behavior as either extrinsically motivated or intrinsically motivated to categorizing it as either controlled or autonomous. Autonomous motivation involves behaving with a full sense of volition and choice, they write, whereas controlled motivation involves behaving with the experience of pressure and demand toward specific outcomes that comes from forces perceived to be external to the self. Autonomy, as they see it, is different from independence. It's not the rugged, go-it-alone, rely-on-nobody individualism of the American cowboy. It means acting with choice, which means we can be both autonomous and happily interdependent with others.